You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I'll be speaking with a woman named Ann Abel. First time she's been on the podcast. Ann is an author, a storyteller, a freelance writer. She has taught, and in 2024, earlier this year, she published her first memoir, Maddie, Milo, and Me, a story of her adoption of a very aggressive dog. And she first told that story, well, I don't know when the first time she told that story, but the first time she made a splash speaking that story was at the Moth Story Slam in New York City, which she won. And I never knew anybody won those things. There is a second memoir on the way, actually about her and Bruce Springsteen. I know we will speak about that. And again, she's written freelance for Philadelphia Daily News, The Jewish Exponent, Philadelphia Weekly, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll talk about her motivation for telling stories and writing stories. I found that super interesting, and I hope you do as well. So thank you, and thanks for listening. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome again to Curiosity Invited. I am here with Ann Abel. That's the person on the screen who doesn't look like me. And Ann is, as I said, she's a writer and a storyteller, and I gave you that introduction. And is there anything that appears, that didn't appear in your bio, that feels like it's important to say?
I don't know. Was my second book in the bio?
It was mentioned, okay. And we will be. And I mentioned in the introduction that we will be speaking about that.
A crazy thing that happened after a couple weeks ago with social media, about social media.
Go ahead, tell me.
I'm 71. I'm not a tech person. I'm not a social media person. But when I signed with She Writes Press, they said we should get on social media. I didn't have a website. I went to my dog walker. She was 34. She's 6 years here from Russia. And she has a company that does birthday parties and science projects and schools. So I said to her, do you know anyone who does social media? And she gave me the name of someone who did it for her, does it for her company, a 19-year-old wonderful boy.
That's what you need.
Right, from CUNY. And we talked, he came over. And so we've been doing, he put me on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. And he would come over once a month and do, as they say, content. And at first they say, you're not supposed to talk about your book. You know, they're supposed to get to know you. And it was, you know, we would show the dogs. It was really painful for me to do. It's really painful for me to do this. And then the book came out and, you know, we promoted it a little. And then about 3 months ago, he sent out a questionnaire. I don't even know how you do this to my followers. And he said, what do you want to see? And they said they wanted to meet my husband and they wanted a tour of my apartment here in New York. So he came over a couple months ago. And I'm telling you, he's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person, which is why it's lasted. I mean, he's competent. He's confident. And he's very nice. And he comes over and he comes at 11. He leaves at 1. I know a little bit about him. There's no chit chat. We sit down. We do it. We do it. I just do whatever he says. And I'm 100% uncomfortable doing it. But that's my life. I live outside my comfort zone. So he came over a couple months ago or 6 weeks ago. And then he said, okay, we're going to do, I introduced him to my husband. And then he said, now we're going to do a tour of your apartment. And I really just turn my brain off and I zone out and I just hobble along like, this is my study. This is my workout room. And I just go through and I'm just like feeling really, really awkward. So then 2 weeks ago, he posted it. And I learned about Amazon rankings for books a few months after mine came out. So I checked my ranking 2 weeks ago, and it is just like, it's like the lowest I've ever, you know, lower. It, like usually on a good day, it would be 100,000. It was 8,000. I mean, and then I look at my Instagram following. We had been unable to break 15,700. It would go close and down. All of a sudden, overnight, I had gained about 800 followers. So I write to the publisher and I say, I don't know if this is a mystery or coincidence, but I got all these new Instagram followers and my ranking is like the lowest I've ever seen. I mean, really low. And then lo and behold, the next day, it turns out this thing about my apartment had gone viral. It had over 2 million views. I had 2,000 comments. And this wonderful, he calls me, he goes, and there are 1,900 comments and so many people are saying they're buying the book. And sure enough, for 2 weeks, I mean, that way I couldn't break 15,007. Now I'm almost at 32,000 on Instagram too. I mean, and the book is just, you know, it's starting to go up a little now, but it was crazy. It was just crazy that people saw this apartment and now they're buying my book. It was like,
what a world.
Yes. What a world. Yeah. No, anyhow, that was something.
Well, so, wait a second. Let's, before we talk about the book, have you always been a storyteller, a writer, somebody who wants to share those things? I mean, you went to school for
chemical engineering, right? My parents made me do that to keep me close to home. I can't add three numbers together. I never got above a C in math or science, and it was a struggle, but I wanted to do whatever they wanted me to do, so I did it.
Right.
And then I got an MBA to try to water that down, and I didn't like spreadsheets any more than chemical equations. And finally, in my mid-40s, I went back to school. I went back to school and got an MFA in creative writing.
Because was that always what sort of made your heart sing? Or at least drew you in that direction?
I did not even know what an interest pattern was. My parents prescripted everything I thought, said, and did. And I just wanted to do whatever they wanted me to do, hoping that eventually they would accept me and love me, which never happened. And then when my oldest son was five, and I was abused as a kid, even though I loved my parents. And one day I was driving my five-year-old to school, and he told me 2 minutes into the 10-minute ride that he had left his lunchbox at home. And I just started screaming at him. And then I just pulled over to the side of the road and I just started apologizing. And someone had given me the name of a therapist who helped people with career changes. We had just moved to Philadelphia from Boston. So I just called her immediately because I needed help being a better mother. So I got there, I told her about the lunchbox, and then I didn't know what to say. And then she said, well, tell me about your mother. Mm-hmm. And in 40 years, there has not been a silence since then. But she said, you know, I didn't know what an interest pattern was. And at one point, about 6 or 8 months into it, she told me I was depressed, which I was just shocked. I mean, since then, I've had 3 rounds of ECT, been hospitalized twice, but I was just shocked. I didn't know that people didn't feel this way, you know, that the way I was feeling wasn't right.
Do you have a recollection of always having felt that way, or did it something that sort of emerged as you grew older?
I remember, my father wasn't someone I spoke to. Every night at the dinner table, he would say to me, and he was the good parent, he would say, you can listen, but don't speak. Even as an adult, if I tried to speak to him, he'd say, don't talk to me. You have nothing interesting to say. When I was 7, he threw my beagle puppy down the stairs and killed him. And again, as I'm saying, he's the good parent. But for some reason, it was actually...
He was the good parent? Is that what you said?
He was the good parent. I mean, he was only 99.9% bad. My mother is what I now know is what was called a dark triad. She was Machiavellian, sociopathic and narcissistic, and she hated me. She just wanted me to suffer. But anyhow, I remember I was 16. We sat down to our Seder. My mother and grandmother were still in the kitchen, and I was sitting next to my father. And for some reason, I remember saying to him, "Dad, I'm feeling really, really sad." And he said, he was a scientist, he said, "On a scale from 1 to 10, with 1 being you're fine and 10 being that you want to kill yourself, where do you stand?" And to be honest, I had never thought about killing, you know, I was just shocked. And that was the end of my opening up. So yeah, yes, I think I had this all along, but I didn't know it was depression. You know, I just knew.
Right. That, and do you look back and think, is this, do you have some insight into where the motivation to tell stories, to write stories, and do you think it comes from, that it somehow emerges from that, or, and, you know, well, go ahead. Let me just do one question at a time. My
mother was the best storyteller. I mean, she, you know, she loved to be the center, and she just, I love listening to my mother tell stories. So I grew up, and it was safe to listen to my mother tell stories, because as long as she was on the stage, you know, she was the center. And then I loved nothing more than being a fly on a wall. I mean, even 20 years ago or 10 years ago, my depression would be worse in the afternoon. Sometimes I would just get in my car and go to the Whole Foods shopping parking lot and just watch people. Like, I just love overhearing conversations, going to Starbucks. I mean, I just get, it takes me out of myself, and it's just fascinating. I love it. But when I, you know, that's not exactly a career path, being a fly on a wall. But in the 90s, you know, Ann Beatty, the author Ann Beatty, while I was seeing this therapist, she came, her book Picturing Will came out, and the protagonist is a photographer. And I read that book and I thought, wow, that's for me. I can have a camera. I can go to PTA meetings. I can go anywhere and I can just watch people. So I went to the Community College of Philadelphia. I heard they had a good program. And I studied photography for 2 years, and I loved it. I loved taking the photographs of people and giving to them. But I hated having the camera between me and the subject. You know, it just distanced me, number one. I'm not technical, even though I was an engineer. I hate fiddling with things. So I hated, like, worrying about the aperture. And also, if you're a photographer, you have to get that shot in that moment. Unlike a writer who can interview someone, go home and think about it, and maybe even call the person back. If you don't get it in that moment, you don't get it. And then toward the end of the 2-year program, this young 18-year-old kid who was really good. And he said to me one day, you should spend more time in the dark room. And I had spent my whole life doing things I should. And the minute he said that to me, like, all these red lights went on, you know, warning lights. And I just got up, I went and found out the name of a creative writing teacher at this community college. I knocked on her door. It was March, middle of the semester. And I said, could I sit in on your class? And the next day, there I was. And I'm not a poetry person, but they were doing a poem about people driving, when you're driving on a highway, and you look at your right and your left, and you see these people, and you're together, whether there's a traffic jam or whatever, but you will never see these people ever again. You will never be. And I thought, oh, do other people think about things like that too? Like, that was kind of the way my mind went. And that was the beginning for me of, I did that class. I took some classes at Penn, and then I got an MFA at the New School for Social Research.
So it's interesting. So you're writing. So I know about Maddie, Milo, and Me, and I know about the next one, the one to come, Bruce Springsteen, and we'll speak about that in a sec. But the other writing that you did for magazines, etc., was it creative writing? I mean, the other two are our memoirs. They are true stories, whatever that means, right? You're writing about reality. You're not making, well, and maybe you are. You're not making stuff up. I mean, you could have been like a fly on the wall at Starbucks and spun that into a tale about that, you know, you got an idea from somebody else. But that's not the sort of writing you do, yeah? That's not the sort of storytelling you do.
No, I mean, I don't mean this really, but why make up stories and have fiction when real life can be so interesting? You know, people, and of course, fiction is just real life put in fiction, but I have never made up a fact, made up anything in any of my writing. I just don't do that. And when I worked for the magazines, I did have a column called The Home Front that I did every other week where I had to come up with ideas. Any, you know, some of them were about school, some of them were actually about me. But I really, my problem, like if an editor said to me, go to out in your backyard, that's a great tree you have. I want a 5,000 word story on that tree and I want it next week. In a week, he would have that story exactly the way he wanted it. But if I looked out the window and thought, you know what? I really love that tree. It's amazing. I'm going to write a story about it. It would just, within a minute, I'd say, so what? Who cares? And I would be under the desk. And that story would be a story that never would be.
Okay, so wait, this is a peculiarity then. So
I suffer, as bad as my depression is, I suffer with debilitating writer's block.
Yeah, I get that. But so you know, you wouldn't write the story. Who cares? You know, it's just like, well, it's just a tree. You're writing it because somebody said, this is what I want. Somebody who's in charge said, this is what I want.
And if someone else said it, then it must be important. It's not me saying it's important. It's someone else.
But but the other thing about you know, you wrote stories. Right. And you've got two books in the works there and you wrote other things. But then you entered these, what do they call them?
Story slams.
The story slams.
Yeah.
Now,
nobody
told you you had to do that. So why did you do that?
Okay. So in 2016, I moved with my husband to Chicago for what was supposed to be 4 months while he visited he's a professor at the University of Chicago. And what do you do when it's 8 degrees in Chicago and you're in Chicago? You sign up for improv. Well, I quickly.
No, who signs up for improv? No, I don't know.
That's what they do in Chicago. What am I going to do? I mean, I have three daughters. It's 8 degrees out. I know no one in that city.
No, I get it. But that's putting yourself out there in a way.
Oh, my God. That first day, my first class, you would think that I was going to stand in front of 8 million people and give a speech. I went back and forth. Should I go? No, you don't have to go. You're 65 years old. You don't need to do it. I mean, I was like, okay, just get yourself there. This was Second City. It was there. And I got myself there. And then, I mean, I did it for about 8 weeks. And I also, there was a theater called I.O. I did it there too. But I loved watching the people, and they were young. They were really young. If I was 65, they were like 18. I mean, you know, 20. I loved watching them. They were so good. But when it was my turn to get up, I really just wanted, like the first class, we had to slither around on the floor. Like, I don't know, forget what. And I would rather have died, but I thought, well, if I just stand here, I'm going to stand out more than if I start slithering around on the floor. So I would do this stuff. And then I will tell you, 2 months into it, it was at I.O. and you were basically, they were using a theater that they use for improv shows, and where you're sitting at these cafe chairs, tables, and then the teacher calls your group up and you go. And my mind just kept going blank, blank, blank. By now it's February. I couldn't come up with anything. And then I thought, you know what? I paid for this class. This is as good as any show I would go to. I'm just going to sit here and enjoy it. So the break came and the teacher comes out to me and goes, so Ann, what's going on? You're not going up. And I just shook my head. He goes, in my class, you either get up or you get out. And he walked away. And I'm like, are you? Like, I was so angry. I put on my coat. I pick up my tote. I'm just like walking out of that room. And then I'm walking out again. It's like 12 degrees out. And I see all my classmates are there. They're mingling in the lobby talking. And I see the exit sign. I'm like, what am I going to do when I walk out of here? And I just, there was a big window and the sun was coming in. It was noon. And I just went over. I put down my bag. I leaned against the window. And I was just standing there trying to get my wits about me. I just had a big fight with my father that weekend. And this kid, he's like 20, 22. I hear he says, "Ann, are you all right?" And I turn around and two of these students from my class are standing there. And I told them, Craig just said, if I don't get up, I have to get out. I just can't do it. And one of them said, and they were both really, really good. One said, "You know, I come to improv because I am so terrified in real life of making a mistake. So I come here to learn to be more comfortable doing it." And then the other kid, you know, said something and they're like, "Ann, you're fine, you're fine." And then it's time, the break's over, everybody goes back. So what do? I pick up my stuff, I follow them back in, I sit at my chair. Group one goes up, then he calls my group. I go up, he splits us on two sides of the stage. And you're supposed to one jumps in, then the other from the other side, and I'm the last one who hasn't gone, and I have no idea. Nothing's coming to me, but I don't want to get kicked out of this class. All of a sudden, I don't know. I just jump out into the middle of the stage, and I throw my hands out and I go, I think I had heard someone say something about a puppet, and I just throw my arms out. And I say, "I am Moses, and I have just come down from the mount." And then, you know, someone comes in, and we're doing this thing. And then, thank God, he pretty quickly called scene. And I just, like, almost literally collapsed. And then as I'm coming off the stage, the woman who had done the scene, she goes, "Oh, Ann, that was really fun doing that scene with you." And as I'm coming down the stairs, the two kids who had seen during the break, they're, "Oh, Ann, that was great, that was great." Anyhow, the class is over, I'm leaving, I'm the last one to leave, and as I'm going out with my back to the teacher, I hear him say, "Ann, good puppet." But you know what? I never went back. I came home, I had a new dog walker, and I said to her, "What do you do when you're not walking dogs?" And she said, "I host storytelling open mic. You should come and tell a story." And I had never heard of storytelling before, and I said, "Well, I'm not going to tell a story, but I'll come and see what it is." And that set me on my trajectory. And it was through storytelling that I actually was able to write these two books.
Okay, I want to talk about the book, so we're definitely doing that next. But, and that moment of deciding this is what you want to do, or this is what you want to do next, where does that come from?
You mean when I say to her, "What do you do when you're not walking dogs?"
No, she says, "I host these things. You ought to come and tell a story." And you do. What is the search for?
Well,
what's the search for?
I did hire. We had this contractor in Philadelphia that we loved. And then we moved to New York and I needed someone. And I called him up and I told him, "I need someone to do something." He's like, "Ann, that's outside my comfort zone." And I said, "Stan, I live outside my comfort zone. The only comfort zone I have is getting into bed with my husband and two dogs. Everything else I do, I push. It's because if I think it's good for me," I went twice inpatient to a psychiatric hospital, an ECT. I was terrified. But if it would help me, if there was a chance that it would help me, I would do it. I will do any, really, I can't think of anything.
You help you to feel better.
To feel better, to move forward. Like, I can't just sit and stare out the window. And it's terrible for your depression to not, and I wanted to be able to write. It was so frustrating. I mean, I love telling stories. My kids used to, they would end up rolling their eyes because where I went, I'd come home and I'd have, or my husband goes to work every day to the University of Pennsylvania. I'd be home, he'd come home, and somehow I would have stories. I mean, I just like to tell stories. You know, I don't know that I thought of it that way, but I always see things, and you know, whether it's in the Whole Foods parking lot, you know, anywhere I go, I find stories for myself to tell. But once I go to write them, it's like, so what? Who cares? This is stupid.
Okay. The book, at least the book that's out.
No, here's the thing. So then when I got to Chicago and they tell me this, when I got to Chicago in 2016, I felt I had one story to tell. For my whole life, I had one story. And that was a trip I had gone on in 2014 to Australia to see Bruce Springsteen's High Hopes tour. I had been teaching at the Community College of Philadelphia for 5 years before that. And then in October of 2013, I had this really violent class, and I'm not easily scared. And after having the fifth week of the semester, having one desk too many thrown at me, I just walked out the door and thought, I am never coming back. But as soon as I was in my car heading home, I was panicking because my husband travels, my kids are living on the opposite coast. And I was terrified that without the structure and focus of the of school, I would get back into the, I had just a year earlier had a third regimen of ECT. They had to stop it early because my memory started to go. I developed horrible jaw pain. They called it atypical jaw pain. That's when they put the bolts through your brain, your jaw, you clench, and even, it was a mess. I was 60 years old. I was not doing any of that again, but I needed something. And as I'm merging onto the expressway, I thought, I know, I'll go to Australia in February and see Bruce Springsteen. Now, a year earlier, at the age of 59, I had never been to a concert. My family, growing up, we did not do fun. My mother got a 1964 Valiant, and she was proud that she didn't have a radio. I didn't watch the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, even though I was of that age, because I wasn't allowed to do that stuff. So then my son, who was living in Boston with his new wife, called up Friday of Labor Day weekend when I was feeling really sorry for myself that my husband and I had no fun plans, not that I do fun. And my son asked if they could come to Philadelphia. I was like, are you kidding? Of course. And then he said, we're going to a Bruce Springsteen concert Sunday night. Would you like to go? And I said, absolutely. Why would I want to go to a Bruce? That's when I go to bed at 7 o'clock. I'm not going to a concert. So Sunday morning, I wake up, I get on my bike. My husband had put Golden Oldies on my headphones. And that's when I get the endorphins really get me going. I got off the bike and I thought, you know what? I want to go to this concert to spend time with my son and daughter-in-law.
Sure.
So off we went, and they had just gotten married in the summer, and I didn't remember any of their wedding because I had been undergoing ECT. So we're sitting there, they're showing me 8,000 pictures from their phones. And all of a sudden, as the crowd mysteriously rose in unison, I rose too. And up on the screen was the face of a man with the biggest, kindest smile I had ever seen. And for the next 3+ hours, that man's energy, humanity, and enthusiasm lifted me. For 3+ hours, Bruce Springsteen made me feel like I had a chance. So the day I quit my job, I went home, Googled Australia real estate travel agent.
Wait, so you knew Bruce Springsteen was touring in Australia?
Somehow, I'd been doing my work. You know, I was chained to my desk. I must have taken a break and seen that somewhere.
Right.
I went home, I Googled Australia travel agents. The first one who called me the next day, I booked the trip. I told her I wanted to see, all I wanted to do was 8 concerts, work out, because I had to work out, she had to find good health clubs. And then out of nowhere, I said, write. I mean, I wasn't, you know, and I hadn't thought about writing in the 5 years I'd been teaching. I've been happy teaching writing. But I think my will to survive or my will to be happy just kind of bubbled up. So the deal was sealed. I was doing it, but then the voice, I mean, I have a really negative head, and the voice in my head said, you're doing what? Ann Able, you are so pathetic that you have nothing better to do with your life than chase an aging rock star across the world. And that voice just looped over and over and over. It was the, you know, you are pathetic, you are pathetic, you are pathetic. Until finally, exactly a month before the trip, then I couldn't even ignore that in 28 days, I'd be on a plane alone to the other side of the world. And for what? I couldn't even remember what I liked about Bruce Springsteen at this point. It was 10 o'clock on January 1st. I sat down and Googled him. And there, up popped Super Bowl 2009. And there, on a halftime stage, surrounded by a football field of cheering, clapping fans, Bruce Springsteen took the mic, leaned into the television camera and said, "Is there anybody alive out there?" And chills just went running through me. And I watched that video 11 multiple times a day until the last, my dreaded day of departure. I get on the plane, I seatbelt myself in, and I'm like, oh, I did it. And then the voice says, "So what, Anne? You got yourself on a plane. Now you're going to fly across the world for nothing." So I, when the plane took off, I just took two Ambien and knocked myself out. And then 8 hours later, I woke up and I was halfway there. I was so excited. And I go into the bathroom, and as I'm pushing the paper towel in the bin with one hand and unlatching the door with the other, I saw myself, glimpsed myself in the mirror, and I turned to face my reflection. And my lips were turned up into a smile, and I could tell I was excited. And as I studied my smile and felt that excitement, a sense of awe came over me. And I pictured Bruce Springsteen high above, looking down and smiling. And I thought, because of this man, Bruce Springsteen, a man who doesn't even know I exist, Ann Abel is about to land in Melbourne, Australia. And I look back at my reflection, at my smile, and I said, "You can do this. You are doing this." And I did. I went to Australia, saw 8 concerts over 26 days in 5 different cities. And I did not go to change. I did not go to have fun because I didn't do fun. I went for structure and focus, but I came home with a positive ball of energy I had never had before. And that trip changed the trajectory of my life. So when I got to Chicago, I knew I had one story to tell. And that was the story I wanted to learn how to tell at an open mic.
And that was the story of Bruce Springsteen, or that was the story of Maddie Milo?
No, Bruce Springsteen. My story was about going on this trip to Australia, just, you know,
yeah.
Face it, if I were 24, it wouldn't be such a story. Or if I'd been following Bruce Springsteen since I was 24, I was 65. Or if I loved to travel, or, you know, there were, but here was a woman who didn't like to travel, who didn't like to be alone, who didn't know who this man was a year earlier. And she's off for 26 days across. So I came home a different. So I knew even I could not tell myself that that wasn't a story.
Like, yes, I knew absolutely. That. So when Bruce Springsteen hears this, kidding, and he says, "I'd like to meet that lady. Would you be willing to come on the podcast with Bruce Springsteen?"
I would be more, if you can get Bruce Springsteen.
You're going to get Bruce Springsteen.
Okay, sure. No problem.
So those open mic stories are short.
The open mics were 7 minutes and the moth is 5 minutes.
Right. So, both of them turned into books. So how does that happen? And when are you going to tell us about Maddie, Milo, and me?
Well, that's the problem. Okay. So here's a story. I knew I had one story. That's Australia. And then I tell it, people love it. Then people started asking me to be in curated shows, you know, so I would start working on other stories, including I had a story about a 7-minute story. It wasn't very good, but that I told at open mics about Milo. And then I decided, and someone said, "You have to go to the Moth." I had never heard of the Moth. I get there, I got up and I won 2 Moths in Chicago, but then I decided I wanted to hone my storytelling skills. I really didn't know what I was doing. So I contacted a coach on the phone, and the first thing she said to me was, which took me by surprise, if I could wave a magic wand and grant you one wish, what would it be? Which I thought she'd want to know my storytelling goals or my history or something. And she took me by surprise, and I said, write a book. And she said, well, then that's what you've got to do. I had never thought of writing a book. I couldn't even write a story. How could I think of writing a book? But I knew she was right. And for 3 months, I just absolutely fought myself on it. I just couldn't do it. Now, meanwhile, when I'd been in Australia, I have to say 12 people before I went said, write to me when you're in Australia and let me know how you're doing. And that was all I needed to get my brain to loosen up. And I would sit every morning at breakfast for 2 or 3 hours. And I would write emails to these 12 people. And I ended up being in the same hotels as Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. But it wasn't just about that. It was for someone who loved being a fly on the wall, imagine being a fly on an A-list wall. I would sit next to Tom Morello, the guitar. I mean, there were times I was sitting next to him in one hotel in the lobby. Our shoulders were touching. He didn't even know I was there. And I'm listening to his conversation. I mean, it was pretty amazing for me to be a fly on a wall with these people. But anyhow, I lost my train.
So wait. Which book came first?
So for 3 months, I just didn't do it. And I was getting more and more angry at myself. So my point is, I had about, believe it or not, 600 or 800 pages of emails that I had written to people that pretty much I don't think anyone read, because no one really cared about my stories. They didn't care about me. They didn't. When I came home and I had this ball of energy, no one wanted to see me. They just wanted to see me as a depressed person. So I had all these emails. And finally, after 3 months, and I work out every day. I never miss a day if my body is working. And I don't think about it. I love the Nike thing. Just do it, because I just get on and I just take a leap of faith that I'm going to feel better afterwards. So one day after 3 months of this, I just said, okay, after you work out, you are going up to your desk and you are going to sit there for 2 hours. So I got up there and it was at 11 o'clock. I opened this binder. I had put all these emails in and I started at the beginning and I just wrote and wrote, and anything that popped into my head, I just put it in there, because if I started questioning if that anecdote or whatever belonged, I would just end up deleting everything. At the end of my first draft of that, of this Australia story, it was 1,000 pages. So we moved to New York. I found someone here to help me edit it. This was during the lockdown. It was like the third or fourth pass back. And she was sitting on it. It was taking forever. And it's the lockdown and I'm going out of my mind. And this friend kept saying, write about Milo. Write about Milo. And I'm like, I can't write about Milo. I can't. And then I found 50 pages I had written shortly after he died. So I just took those 50 pages and soon I had a beginning, middle, and end. And I realized that the story of Milo was a more straightforward story. So I decided to try to get that story out into the world and then come back and work on the Australian
story. Understood.
Which is what happened.
Yeah. So can you tell the story of Milo, Maddie, and me very briefly?
I can tell it to you in 5 minutes. Is that too?
Because you've timed it.
So I never wanted a dog, but my middle son was born saying the word dog, and I got him every kind of caged animal you could possibly get. And then for his 10th birthday, it was in January, I saw an article that said African hedgehog, the perfect pet. So I was like, this is perfect. Great. And he's like, yeah, if I can't get a dog, I'll get an African hedgehog. And I called the store owner for directions in those days. And he said, well, I just want you to know, this is basically a porcupine. You'll need to wear rubber gloves. And I was like, okay, we got enough of these. It's time for the dog. And I absolutely not a shopper. I moved from Boston to Philadelphia and bought the third house I looked at. I just don't shop. Go, you need an appliance, you go, you find one that's good enough. But good enough was not going to cut it with the dog. So I got a book. We were studying it. One day my son came home from somewhere. He'd seen a Wheaton Terrier. I'd look it up in the book. It does everything but empty the dishwasher. This was our dog. I call the breeder from the It was January. She said, well, we're having a litter in May. We will put you on the list. And I just hung up. Sometimes it was so easy to be a good mother. It was January. May was a lifetime away. I was in good shape. 4 days later, this breeder called and said, well, actually, we have this 10-month-old dog named Maddie. We were going to use her as a show dog, but her neck's too short. If you come out this weekend, we can meet the kids. You could go home that Sunday with the dog. Now, I could have said, no, we just want a puppy. I could have not told my kids about it, but my goal in life at that point was to be a good mother, the best mother I could be. So I didn't do that. So Sunday, they got in the car. I walked through my house thinking, it is never going to look like this again. And I was even more depressed than usual driving the 45 minutes to the breeder. I didn't even hear what they were talking about. We go in, the kids check out. They go in the kitchen. We'll send Maddie in. So I'm just standing there pretty comatose. All of a sudden, this white ball of fluff comes bounding up from the basement. And she runs around my family. And then she lands at my feet. And I collapse. And I hug her. And I was in love. I was just absolutely in love with Maddie. And for 7 years, she was just like a living hug or a living stuffed animal. We just put her out in the backyard. I never wanted to walk a dog. That's what I told before I got the dog. You know, I said, I see people when I go swimming at 5:30 in the morning, they're out there walking their dogs in the cold. And they're like, no problem. But of course, we never took Maddie. I would be working and I would look at her by my desk and it would just make me feel good. It was good for my depression to have Maddie. She was wonderful. And then one day, it was December, I came home, let her out. I still had my jacket on, and I hear a knock at the door, the front door. I answer it, and it's a jacketless packages UPS man. And he says, I'm sorry, ma'am. I just hit your dog and killed her.
Oh, wow.
So I just collapsed to the floor. When I could finally stand up, I called Maddie's breeder. I knew getting another dog wasn't going to make me miss Maddie less, but I was terrified that the void left by her death would push me into the abyss. And the breeder wasn't breeding, and he said, well, would you take a rescue? I said, I'll take anything. And the next day, we're at the rescue, and there was the owner of the rescue was there in a meadow with the most beautiful, regal, sphinx-like dog. His name Milo, and we even nicknamed him Mellow Milo because he just was so wonderful. Of course, he was 4 times the size I asked for, but that didn't matter. We get him the next day. He was Milo the monster. He started biting my kids on that. And the first day, as I'm wrapping the bandage around my son's bloody wrist, he said, you know, Mom, I bet they sedated Milo at the rescue before we got there. And as soon as he said it, it was obvious. And I thought, I'm taking this monster back. But then the guy had put him back in the kennel and made us walk through the kennel to show us supposedly other dogs. And all the other dogs are at the, you know, at the cages barking and yapping. And Milo's just curled up in a ball in a bed of rags. He was absolutely sedated. And when I thought of putting him back on that bed, I just couldn't do it. I didn't know if I could live with him, but I knew I couldn't live with myself if I didn't try. So I got us to a dog school, and the woman who owns the school, I just put all my faith in her. And I did so for 6 months, I'm a woman who didn't want a dog. I don't want to walk a dog. For 6 months, I was going to classes every day, every week. At first, she had to put us in a separate room because he was too, everything was a trigger. People, birds, squirrels, buses, cars, everything was a trigger for Milo. But after 6 months, one day she said, Ann, you're finally ready. She wanted us to take dog gymnastics. I said, I'm done. And she said, okay, but your work with Milo has just begun. And every morning, you need to take him into the woods for an hour and let him be the living being he was meant to be. And I hate the woods. I hate hiking in the woods alone every day for an hour. But I'm a very disciplined person. And every day for 10 years, no matter what the weather, I had crampons for the ice. And I will tell you, I never, ever liked it, except I'd be trudging down the muddy path of whatever, the slippery path. Just, it was an hour door to door. And I'm counting down the minutes. And all of a sudden, Milo would come soaring across my path. And he was a beautiful dog. And he would just looking like, just being the being he was meant to be. And that would just stop me in my tracks. And I had heard about empathetic joy in meditation classes, but never really experienced it. And seeing this living being, being this creature, and comparing him to the dog on the bed of rags, it just made me feel so good that I was able to do that, to do this for another living being. And that, and you know, and Milo had a joie de vivre, which I sure didn't have. So, you know, I fell in love with Milo. He helped me and I helped him.
So an observation, worth nothing. When you were speaking about Milo and taking him in, you had a big smile on your face and exuded what looked from the outside like joy. So what is it that's going on in your life right now that brings you that joy?
Well, I don't know if you can hear in the background.
I hear that.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to, can I just shut the door for 1 second?
Sure.
Because it's, or is it okay? That
it's fine with me. It's fine. It's Bichon, right? It's the Bichon?
Yeah, no. Let me just shut the door. So, in the final page, after 10 years, one Monday, I get to the dog park with Milo on a Monday, and he won't get out of the trunk of my station wagon. I take him over to the vet. Long story short, the guy, he had cancer from his butt to his head. The guy said, just take him home. There's nothing you can do. And Friday morning, my husband went out and bought sirloin steak. Milo wouldn't eat it. My husband put him down. I talked my way into the same rescue. I called Friday after my class, and they're like, no, you can't. You have to make an appointment. But I was very persuasive. The next morning, I'm there. And the guy who had given me Milo, he was now a celebrity. He's a real operator. They got rid of him from this rescue because he has dubious methods. But he hands me this perfect little Bichon. This Bichon, he goes, this is a gift for taking Milo. And we go out. It was Sam, and he was just perfect. We go outside with him. I'm like, okay, yep, I want this dog. I go to the receptionist, tell her that. She goes, okay, just a minute. Bill said he wanted to know. Bill comes out. He's holding this little Chihuahua in his arms. And he's talking to me, and he's like, well, this is Yat. I found him when I went to a puppy mill raid. He was just there by the side of the road. I picked him up, and I brought him. They told me his name's Yat. And I didn't want two dogs, but Sam was just like this. Anyone would want Sam, the Bichon. So we took Sam out, and I thought, okay, I'll take Ryan. So we took Yat. We took them both. And also, Yat had this little heart on his back, a brown heart. And I love hearts. So we get home, and we had Ryan until last April. He was 19 and a half years old. So he died in April. Meanwhile, Sam had died of cancer. And when he was sick, we did chemo. But then we went to a Bichon rescue, and we got a dog. We brought her home. After a month, I said to my husband, Megan's not Sam. So we kept her, but we went back to the rescue and we got another dog, Bichon, and we brought him home. And I said, Chase is not Sam. But now we're just so Ryan, we had these three dogs. Ryan died at 19 and a half in April. And then Megan just quickly went downhill and died in August. And I'd had six dogs. I had never had a puppy, but I needed something to fill that void. We are who we are. Just like I went out and got Milo the next day. So the next morning we were going out of town. I got up at 4:30. I Googled Cavapoo puppies because the woman who narrated Maddie, Milo, and me has a Cavapoo. And I'd see her posting it on Instagram and it looked really cute. So I Googled that. I filled out some forms online. I hate filling out forms online. Also, rescues, you know, I didn't want to go through the whole vetting process. I just want. So within 3 hours, I had secured myself a Cavapoo puppy coming to me from Missouri. And that is now, I used to say I haven't been this tired since I had it. So we have 15-year-old Chase who's sick. And he was trouble from day one, and he is really aggressive. He is really, really, really difficult. My husband says Chase is going to write a book called When Hate Means Love, because sometimes I'll just scream at him and say, Chase, I hate you, but I will do anything for that dog. And my husband just told me that Wendell, that's the Cavapoo, is going to start a podcast called Chew on This. But anyhow, so I used, up until a few weeks ago, I was saying I hadn't been this tired since I had a 2.5-year-old and a newborn. Now I say I have never been this tired, because plus my husband's had unrelated surgeries in 3 months. So I've got that. But I will tell you, there is nothing cuter than Wendell or a Cavapoo. So
oh yes, they are very cute.
Not smile at him.
So. They are very cute. Well, I'm looking at the time, and so what else needs to be said before we say goodbye? About your books, about your life, about Bruce Springsteen.
On my tombstone, I want them to write, "She tried and she tried and she tried," because I am always trying. I am always trying. I just try.
What are you trying to do?
To help myself, to help the people around me, I try to do the effort, which is to have fun. I just try. I could just slide under the, I know it doesn't seem like that. I could just slide under this desk and curl up into a ball, but I do not let myself do that. And if this social media guy wants me to do a tour of my apartment, I will grit my teeth. I will brace myself and I will do the tour of the apartment because he says it's good. So I will just do anything to help someone.
Well, is there one more rock star in the, that might be chased down the road for 6 months?
No, he really helped me. It was a lot. I grabbed onto a lot. Huh. That was my lifeline.
Yeah.
It gave me my life.
Yeah. Which is great. Well, I'm glad it did. I am a Bruce Springsteen fan, so I understand completely. Puts on the best shows. And thank you for giving up some of your time and having this conversation.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.